Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Welcome to the Fallon Forum. This is Ed Fallon. I am your host, and we're coming to you from the heart of America's heartland, Des Moines, Iowa. Underwriting for this program provided by Gateway Market, a Des Moines grocery and cafe offering artisan, local, and global foods, and catering for business and social events. More information at gatewaymarket.com. And the program's bumper music provided by the Des Moines Irish Session. So, hey, before we talk about the upcoming election, which is way more important than most people realize, I want to talk briefly about the heat waves. Yeah, it's bad here. It's been, you know, not terrible in the Midwest yet, but bad enough for certain weeks. It's real worse in Europe and even worse, I think, in India. I had scheduled a call with a woman from India to talk about AI last week, and she had to cancel because the heat wave has basically disrupted the power grid so bad that there were outages for most of a week. The Carnegie Endowment for International Peace wrote this: heat waves strike segments of society very differently, especially in India. Those who can move through the crisis in air-conditioned cocoons, homes, cars, offices, malls, can escape some of the worst effects. Roughly three quarters of India's workforce, about 380 million people, labors in heat-exposed sectors like agriculture, construction, and up to 90% of the labor force in India works informally without contracts guaranteeing basic protections, mandatory rest breaks, or employer liability, and only 8% of Indian households have air conditioning. Driven in part by the oppressive heat, India's electricity demand has hit an all-time high and it crossed 270 gigawatts for the first time on May 21st. And yet, our country continues to, under the leadership, I'm putting that in quotes, of Donald Trump, continue to pretend that climate change isn't happening. But the heat waves in Europe and India, you know, scientists have made it clear and been explicit about it. Those would not have happened, could not have happened without climate change. Let's move on to I want to start one more thing here on this kind of a relevant topic. Trump's big party in D.C. apparently one after effect of that was that Washington, D.C. residents had to breathe in unhealthy air for hours after the 40-minute fireworks display over the National Mall. And not only bad air, but the country's capital, the Washington, D.C., briefly recorded the worst air quality of any major city in the world. Okay. And at the same time, of course, President Trump is rolling back all kinds of pollution control initiatives. But, you know, I mean, climate change is huge on my radar. So is the threat of nuclear war. So is the growing risk presented by AI. But they're all kind of right back burner right now, which is crazy to say that. But they're back burner to what's happening to our democracy, because you cannot address any of these problems without a functioning democracy. And the current administration... And I regard Trump as somewhat of a puppet figurehead, but there are people behind him pulling the strings that are really making this this horrible stuff happen, this erosion of the pillars of our democratic governance. And I think the The urgency of this fall's election was driven home very strongly by a guy named Rick Wilson. Now, Rick Wilson, he was a Republican, I mean, a very prominent Republican operative for many years. He produced TV commercials for a number of governors, U.S. Senate candidates, even for super PACs, for corporations as well. He served under George H.W. Bush. He served as the field director for the Bush campaign in Florida. Yet after Trump won in 2016, he left the GOP. And he wrote a column recently that really caught my attention. And I'll read some of it to you. Wilson writes, "Let me tell you a secret about the MAGA movement that isn't a secret at all because they keep saying it out loud. They know they can't win a fair fight in November. They've seen the same numbers you have. They've watched the special elections. They've read the internal polling that leaks out of the NRCC, that's the National Republican Congressional Committee, and the National Republican Senatorial Committee. For the love of God," writes Wilson, "stop trying to shame the Republican Party into decency. I watched this party from the inside for 30 years. There is no bottom. There is no invisible line of conscience. There is no cavalry of serious Republicans waiting for permission to do the right thing. The ones with even marginally functioning consciences already left. What remains is an apparatus that responds to exactly two stimuli, power and fear of losing it. Every hour spent crafting the perfect appeal to their better angels is an hour donated to the opposition. They are not going to be shamed. They can only be beaten." And then Wilson writes this regarding ICE and the campaign of deportations. "Stop thinking about this as immigration policy, because it isn't one. Deportation policy doesn't require masked agents. It doesn't require flooding blue cities with federal muscle and doesn't require a social media operation that packages the raids like content. What it does accomplish is something much older and much darker. It conditions the country to the sight of federal force deployed against civilians in democratic cities, and it conditions the agencies themselves to follow orders that would have been unthinkable 5 years ago. Every authoritarian project runs this rehearsal. You normalize the presence of the boot before you decide whose throat to crush with it. And where they intend to put it is in key states and districts this election season. We'll see federal agents, quote, monitoring polling places in Philadelphia, Atlanta, Detroit, Phoenix, and Milwaukee." And this is me adding, yeah, in Iowa as well. Wilson continues, "Fraud investigations will happen to target the local grassroots groups and activists in the exact counties Democrats need to run up the margins. Emergency declarations from imaginary threats will land like a heavy rain in the days before the election. The infrastructure being built on the streets right now is dual usage, and the second use is for November. The MAGA Media and Tech Alliance isn't just writing checks anymore. It owns platforms, it owns cable networks, it owns news outlets, it owns AI models, and it owns the pipes. And I will add that it owns commercial radio. AI-generated content at industrial scale, synthetic local news sites metastasizing across swing states, deepfakes time for the final 72 hours when corrections can't catch the lie. Here's the strategic core, and it's the oldest rule in the book. Cheating operations works on the margins. They flip close races. They exploit recounts, certification fights, faithless officials, and friendly courts. What they cannot do, what no operation in American history has ever managed to do, is steal a landslide. A three-point race in Wisconsin can be litigated, delayed, investigated, and strangled in a certification meeting. An eight-point race cannot. The math of the steal collapses when the margin exceeds the degree of MAGA election meddling. So that's the assignment. Register voters like it's existential, because it is. Bank early votes like the polls might not be open on election day, because in some counties, functionally, they might not be. Fund the lawyers, protect the election workers, prosecute the criminals, and run up the score in every district everywhere, including the ones the smart money consultants wrote off. A political war is coming this fall. Not a metaphor, not hype, an actual contest over whether elections in this country still decide who holds power. The other side is already mobilized. They have the court, the money, the federal agencies, and the machines. You have the numbers. You have the law. And you have about 90 days. Win so big they can't cheat. There is no plan B. Again, that's from Rick Wilson, former Republican operative. I mean, big-time Republican. Again, worked for George H.W. Bush. Field director in Florida for his campaign. He left when Trump won in 2016. And he's been vocal about just how important this upcoming election is. I am on an FCC-regulated station, and I know how all this works. And I will tell you that this is not an endorsement of electing Democrats. This is an endorsement of electing people who have a conscience, people who will stand up to the continued push toward authoritarianism. You know, I mean, I look at the people who were recently ousted from the from Congress on the Republican side, people who had some sense of independence, some willingness to speak up against the administration, like Thomas Massie. And, you know, again, there are people out there who, if empowered by the voters, would have the capacity to stand up to authoritarianism. There's so many different ways in which the Trump administration is undercutting the sanctity of our election process. And we can talk, we've talked about a lot of them on the show. A recent one, a U.S. Supreme Court ruling on campaign finance. This was back on June 30th. And the Supreme Court voted 6-3. Guess which three? Voted no. The 6-3 vote allows political parties to spend unlimited money in direct coordination with candidates. So now a donor who used to be able to, you know, give no more than $7,000, I think that covers both the primary and the general election. Now they can give, well, $500,000 to a candidate through the party. You know, no conflict of interest there at all. So again, there is going to be a huge amount of money spent on this election. And again, there will be plenty spent on the Democratic side. And as you know, I despise the amount of money that is spent on elections. It's so out of hand. So I've said this before, when I ran for governor in 2006 in Iowa, I raised $500,000, which I thought was pretty good. I was outspent 3-1 by both of my opponents, even though I had three times as many donations. So it's gone from bad to worse, and it just took a real big turn for the worse back in on June 30th. It's going to make a difference this fall. So yeah, if you talk to your friends, your neighbors, family members, tell them how important it is to get out and vote. What is it? The turnout for elections is just dismal in this country. That's got to change. That's got to change, and it's got to change fast. Again, as Wilson writes, we've got 90 days, and by the time you're hearing this, it will be less than 90 days to figure out how to engage ourselves and our neighbors, friends, family in this process to make a difference anyway. I could talk more about this, but that's all I want to say for now about it, because I got a guest joining me here shortly, Jeffrey Weiss. We got a couple interesting things to talk about. One is kind of revisiting Jeffrey's proposal for a national divorce, cutting the country in two. He loves the idea, thinks it has to happen. I don't. We'll talk about that. We'll also be talking about the rise of democratic socialism, which seems to have the elite of the Democratic Party all in quite a snit. I mean, they are not happy about this. And also how the media tends to cover both sides of the political spectrum very differently when it's talking about, quote, the left versus, quote, the right. More about that when we come back from a short break. Again, a reminder that underwriting for this program is provided in part by Dr. David Drake, a psychiatrist serving patients in Iowa and Colorado. More information at 515-229-5085. Ed Fallon, with you folks, back in a minute.
Thanks to Central Iowa Realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Again, Ed Fallon with you here, your host, broadcasting from Des Moines, Iowa, right smack in the middle of the U.S. Hey, underwriting for this program provided by real estate agent Joe Henry. More information at 515-208-7312. Hey, I'm welcoming Jeffrey Wise to the program. Jeffrey is a poli-sci prof at Des Moines Area Community College, and he's on this program once in a while to share his perspective on various and sundry. And we have talked about this before. We're going to talk about it again. Jeffrey is he's a marriage counselor of sorts, and he figures that America, the U.S., needs a divorce. We are not on the same page on this, but let's kick it off by Jeffrey telling us, first of all, why you think it's time to split the country in half.
Yeah, you know, when the 55 men went to Philadelphia to change what was clearly not working, the Articles of Confederation, they decided to write a constitution instead. Here we are now. Levitsky and Zablot, a couple of Harvard professors, have written a few books the last few years, How Democracies Die and the Tyranny of Minority Rule, about the United States. And they argue that the United States will either become a multiracial democracy or will live under authoritarianism. We've now arrived at some kind of autocracy, according to leading democratic index around the world. It's called democratic backsliding. It's we're here, it's now. And so because a constitutional convention is not possible or plausible, given the way our constitution is written, and because the fissures in our society are so deep, and because we have hundreds of years, we have centuries of understanding that parliamentary governments with proportional representation voting are absolutely perfect for a population of 345 diverse people, it's time to...
345 million.
Yeah, I'm sorry, 345 million or whatever the population of the United States is. Yeah, but it's really time to separate the United States on opposite sides of the Mississippi River. We can have a transition phase. When Czechoslovakia separated east-west in 1993, It's now the Czech Republic. It's now Slovakia. It's worked out wonderfully. I think Thomas Jefferson would be proud of this proposal. In the Declaration of Independence, he said, if a government is not working, it is your duty to replace it. And so, you know, this is my idea. The alternative to this is that all of us, including my children, my children's children, my children's children, will live in semi-authoritarianism for decades and decades and decades and decades and perhaps centuries. Climate change will perhaps destroy us anyway, as will launching the possibility of launching nuclear weapons. And so this is a solution to the problem. You could have a white Christian ethnostate on one side. You could have a Norway on the other side, or Sweden, or something like that. But you would finally have taxation with representation on both sides of the Mississippi, because in the transition phase, which could take a long time, the factions could determine what form of government they want, what form of voting. They could start over from scratch. The last thing I will say is, similar to the Czech Republic and Slovakia in their what was called the Velvet Divorce. I mean, maybe we could have another name for this divorce. They decided that they would have free travel between both places. That would be a little bit like the EU, where you could come in and out of either new republic or new country, and you could, you know, do business both places, etc. So, you know, during the year or two transition where people could go to one or the other side of the Mississippi, even if they decided differently, they could travel to the other side quite freely. But these arrangements could be worked out between between the two new republics, in which would be able to call themselves whatever they wanted to.
I have so many questions, Jeffrey. Mm-hmm. Are you surprised?
No.
No. I mean, first of all, I mean, the Czech Republic and Slovakia, very small countries. And that, yeah, that may have worked out just fine. And one of them made it to the World Cup this year. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. But most of these split ups don't work out really well. Even in the other country that I call home, Ireland, in 1922, after the much-needed revolution against mm-hmm. you know, British domination, there was a civil war. You know, they devolved right into civil war, almost as soon as the Battle of Independence was over. India, Pakistan, look what a mess that's been. I mean, Pakistan, Bangladesh, India were all at one time one country. At one time, Pakistan and Bangladesh were the same country, even though they're separated by 1,000 miles in between them, I guess. Mm-hmm. Sudan, southern Sudan. These things don't normally work out really well. Mm-hmm. And the first attempt at dividing the country in two, back in the mid-1800s, the Civil War, did not go real well. How do you expect this one to go any better?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would go well. We're already living together in relative harmony, although lots of discontent. I mean, most voters, according to the polls, you know, feel disenfranchised. I mean, Congress has a lower approval rating than Al Qaeda, you know.
Is that for real?
Pretty close. It's really, yeah. Then, yeah. Okay. I think it's about 10%, 12% or something.
Bad.
Yeah, it's really bad. You know, and really, I think that, you know, you probably have 20% of the population that, you know, would fit the white ethno-Christian state, 20% that would sort of be down vocally for some kind of a social market economy, parliamentary republic, proportional representation. I don't know, maybe 30% of the population, you know, just completely oblivious. And then 30% of the population, sort of Rodney King, you know, can we just all get along? And so really, those that are most vocal for wanting a multiracial democracy against those who embrace authoritarianism, which one of our two political parties clearly has, you know, will lead the charge, so to speak. And the other 60% would fit in. We all speak roughly the same language. This would be done not in a time of war. It would not be in a time of like what we're talking about with, you know, what was going to be, what was it, East Pakistan, or, you know, and all, you know, these are different nationalities with different languages. This could be done harmoniously. It could be done over a period of time. Honestly, it could be done with a handshake, a high five, a kiss on the cheek, however it needs to be done.
A kiss on the cheek, you mean like Judas and Jesus?
It would not be a betrayal, because Thomas Jefferson and our founders instructed us that freedom mattered, that freedom should matter. I know that in our country, the word freedom is a word we used to talk about and care about. When I was a child, I was instructed by nuns to care about that word and
think about
it.
I think we still care about it.
I think it's been largely replaced by safety, and being safe. And, you know, I've sometimes said that you get a lot of safety in North Korea if you want safety, and people
but you
still
have no freedom.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, people still party in North Korea. They go to restaurants, they dance, they, you know, you see the same thing with the authoritarianism in the Russian Federation, which our country is slowly but surely, coming closer, especially with our Supreme Court's recent decisions, it's not a comparison that I've drawn much, but with the recent decisions by the Supreme Court, they just sort of add to my PowerPoint about why a divorce would probably be the best option.
So let me ask you this:
because a multiracial democracy is not in reach.
When did things start going sour in this country?
You know, part of what when I was writing my so-called book about how presidential republics fail, part of my argument was that the United States was just late for the party, meaning nearly every African country, South American country that's adopted a presidential republic has drifted into executive tyranny where...
Except for Costa Rica.
And Uruguay is another one. Yeah, there's a few other presidential republics that have managed differently. And one of the reasons is they tend to become executive dictatorships where the executive captures the captures the referees. In other words, the legislative branch, the judiciary. And I think ours was late to the party, but now it's truly arrived. I mean, the Supreme Court allowing a president to fire the heads of independent regulatory agencies, it does appear that presidents will be able to.
But when did it start? When do you? I have my own answer to this question.
Yeah.
But when do you think the slide into authoritarianism began?
You know, the largest slide in we've always had that element. You know, I mean, part of what is happening now with the Republican Party looks like the Democratic Party after Reconstruction. You know, where Jim and Jane Crow entered the pictures when federal soldiers left the South, and you know, African Americans were denied citizenship, and then the white majority got along and didn't kill each other for 100 years, but then by putting down the minority, but then in 1965, you finally become a democracy with the Voting Rights Act, where African Americans finally become citizens in 1965. So we've always had an element of it. There's always been this, are we going to be a multiracial democracy, or are we going to be authoritarian? And I think the answer is very clear. We're going to be authoritarian because our form of government, our form of voting plurality, the role of money in elections, the way our Constitution is literally about impossible to change, 400 or so House of Representatives elections being rigged, the Senate malapportioned.
Yeah, by rigged, you mean gerrymandered.
Gerrymandered, right, absolutely. Okay. And the Supreme Court is fine with that. Elections themselves that are run by partisans, which I don't think people in the United States really understand like how unusual these things are when you compare the United States with other governments, how really out there they are. So I guess my response back to Levitsky and Zablot is they have a great chapter at the end of their book about all these reforms that need to be made. But as I look at every one of these reforms, I say they're close to impossible or completely implausible. So let's move on.
You mentioned the Constitutional Convention. That's not impossible. It's a challenge, but the already great progress has been made toward calling a constitutional convention. If I remember correctly, 38 states their legislatures have to approve the proposal for one, and if that threshold is reached, then it happens. Correct?
Yeah. I don't maybe you disagree with me, but I don't see a universe where 38 of the 50 states that are led by Republicans and Democrats would want to call a constitutional convention.
But aren't we getting close to that number?
I would think several generations will be dead. My kids, their kids' kids, if they have them. I mean, before that could possibly happen. And I'm glad you asked, because I think this is really part of my argument, is that if you're not for breaking up the republic, what are you for? And I'm not even putting that on you. I'm just saying, like, one of the things I like to do when I do public presentations on this is just get a discussion started about where we go. And I've had people in these outings say, well, how about four states secede? And I'm like, hey, let's talk about it, you know, because I think we need to really think outside of the box.
I think we need counseling, you know? Not a divorce. And certainly, if counseling fails, then maybe you get a divorce. But I don't see divorces going well.
I like the divorce analogy, because a government is a third party that negotiates the problems between citizens. That's part of what government does. That's why government's a wonderful thing, really, is that without government, you know, you'd go retaliate against your neighbor rather than call the police, which might not go well. You know, honey, I'm going down the block. I got a stick in my hand. I'm going down the alley.
Vigilante justice.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Or you know, what Afghanistan was like for part of this century, for example, now that it's, you know, it's stabilized today. But
if you can call life under the Taliban stabilized, especially if you're a woman.
It's a lot more promising for more Afghans, because there's a lack of war. There's safety. There's not freedom, but there's safety.
But the I don't see, it's okay. Let's say you divide the country east-west. Sure. Although logically, if you look at where the pockets of, quote, where are the blue pockets? Well, there are states like New York, but then what? The top 3/4 of New York is, quote, red. Sure. And even like New Hampshire, Maine, all these, there isn't a single state in the country that, even if I might vote blue or red because of a dominant, overwhelming majority of Republicans or Democrats. I mean, look at Iowa. Iowa's been going red for a while, but Des Moines is a solidly Democratic city. Sure. So is Iowa City. So are several other places. So what happens to places like, I don't know which half of the country you'd want to see be the blue half, or which would be the red half.
I don't really care if a coin is flipped or however it works out. I really don't. I mean, I think that it's really not about polarization per se. Polarization matters. I mean, the fact that it's so different from when you and I were kids, the fact that it's not the fault of the Republican Party, but they have a huge advantage by being a rural party, because the Democrats have to essentially outvote them by like 5 to 7 percentage points to win the Senate. Win the presidency, they have to win by 4 to 6%.
Sure, there's no reason the Republican Party has to be the rural party. And gosh, look at the policies.
Well, but the reality is, not only is it, but the Supreme Court has cemented this gerrymandering. You don't no longer have to. African Americans no longer need, you know, taxation with representation, in the South. So I think that really this is a matter of it would work out, and it would take a lot of time. People would have a lot of time to choose what side they were on.
I think it would be an absolute unmitigated disaster. I mean, who gets to keep the nuclear weapons?
Well, it would
Which country becomes the one?
Opportunity to not live in authoritarianism for the next 300. Have climate catastrophe.
And you'd have an authoritarian next door neighbor who doesn't give a dang about climate change. And if they're upwind, they're sending all their pollution your way. I mean,
Those things will have to be worked out. But those things are worked out between countries all the time. International law is for.
I don't see how they get worked out. I mean, I know. Yeah. Okay. You can say you've got China. And Russia next to each other, both with nuclear weapons. You've got Pakistan and India, both with nuclear weapons. Yeah. I guess you could have US A and US B with nuclear weapons, but I don't see how it goes well at all.
Sure. Well, prefer to live under authoritarianism for hundreds and hundreds of years, that's fine.
Here's what I prefer. I prefer actually changing the flaw, addressing the flaws in our system, getting rid of the Electoral College. Getting rid of gerrymandering. I mean,
Iowa,
we're one of the few states that don't have gerrymandering. We have a system that works. Yeah. And you could that could be the law of the land across the country.
Okay. Well, so how many years to replace the full Supreme Court? Wait for that. And well, and you're also that, you also live in a system where the idea of democracy is that the people who win the most votes get to govern. The United States does not have whoever gets the most votes gets to govern for presidency, for the Senate.
That needs to change.
Or for the House of Representatives.
That needs to change.
But my argument is it's not going to change for hundreds of years because the Constitution makes it impossible to change or implausible to change. We've changed the Constitution 17 times since 1789. Two were about alcohol. I mean, my God, well, we would flip on a minute on alcohol, yeah. Right? Like, don't ban our alcohol. That matters. But, but yeah. And I mean, I still think everybody should work for democracy. We should resist. We should care about freedom. This is what I was taught. This is what our, you know, was the lesson from Jefferson and others. I just feel like the founders, some of the founders would really like the idea of starting all over. And I think the best way to start all over when you have a vision of people who want authoritarianism and a vision of people who want some kind of social market economy or appear to want some kind of democratic socialism or something like Canada or Norway would be to allow them the freedom to actually have that and to start from scratch.
Democratic socialism. Let's talk about that for a bit, but let's take a short break here first. Folks, this is Ed Fallon. My guest is Jeffrey Weiss. Back in a minute, and a reminder that underwriting for this program provided by Western Optometry. More information at 515-789-3055. Back in a minute. Our D-I-V-O-R-C-E becomes final today. Thanks to our nonprofit partners, including Circle of Peacemakers. Formerly the Catholic Peace Ministry, Circle of Peacemakers works with people of all faiths toward a world without war. CPM opposes runaway military spending while domestic needs go unmet. Instead of endless wars, CPM supports diplomacy. Visit circleofpeacemakers.com. At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrom's primary concern. Dr. Westrom and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Western Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village. Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you here, folks, broadcasting from the heart of America's heartland, Des Moines, Iowa. Hey, underwriting provided by Architecture by Synthesis. More information at architecturebysynthesis.com. All right, Jeffrey Weiss, my guest today, and we're done dividing the country in half. But let's divide the Democratic Party in half now. Let's keep our knife sharp here. Democratic socialism, arguably by some, is on the rise because of the primaries that were won by several progressive candidates in New York and Colorado and other places doing well. And it's of particular interest to me and Jeffrey how the mainstream media, or really, come on, it's the corporate media, how the corporate media tends to cover this. And you've written some interesting stuff about this lately, Jeff. looking at the New York Times and NPR, what are you seeing that's raising red flags?
Yeah, I mean, the challenge for the Democratic Party, if they can figure it out, is, well, if you have proportional representation, you wouldn't have to worry about it. You bust the party into multiple, but that's the last thing.
Let's do that instead of divorcing.
Yeah, that's the last thing. Well, we have to have the divorce to get that. But
We're done with that.
The polling shows, there's any number of polls that people could look at that show that it does appear that the majority of voters in the Democratic Party lean Democratic Socialist. Now, what that means, I try to explain it as capitalism for profit, for broccoli, for haircuts, for things people want, and more socialism or more government for healthcare, for education, for housing, for things that people need.
Haircuts are not essential?
Well,
broccoli is not essential?
Depending on how you want your haircut, I suppose, or what, you know, kind of, if you want organic broccoli, things like that. That's better for capitalism. It's better for, you know, a seller wants to sell as little as possible for as much as possible. Buyer wants to buy as much as possible for as little as possible. You know, the price signal, or what is called a so-called a free market, even though there's no such thing as a free market. But having said that, all countries have mixed economies. I mean, all countries have a private sector, all countries have a public sector, and the United States is no different. When you're living in a media environment that's owned by Disney and Comcast and large corporations, the Mondamis of the world are going to frighten them because they are more socialistic for needs. And therefore, the healthcare industry and others, as you know, all these different industrial complex of digital complex of industries that reap massive profits are definitely worried about this trend in the Democratic Party and Democratic voters. Now, it's simply what the voters want, according to the polls. So unless the National Democratic Party wants to alienate its own voters, which it might, and continue to lose elections.
Well, it's been really successful at alienating the, you know, a big chunk of the American electorate and losing elections. But that's changing this year. You know, and I talked about that during the first segment, how, you know, the elections have been going well for Democrats, and Republicans are really concerned about what's going to happen this fall. So they're pulling out all the stops to make sure the election doesn't work the way they're supposed to. But that's another conversation, one we've already had, we'll probably have again. Mm-hmm. But what is it specifically in, what do you see in, I take the New York Times, that's kind of the primary mouthpiece of Wall Street.
Sure.
What do you see in the New York Times in terms of this conversation that raises red flags?
Well, I mean, for the New York Times and for a lot of what is called, you know, establishment media, their really focus on reporting is very much on, you know, the conflict within the party. I mean, they love the stories where they can quote establishment members of the party, the Chuck Schumers of the world, and, you know, the division. You know, media loves conflict. They love division.
Well, they also love using the word moderate to describe what I would call a corporate Democrat.
Absolutely.
Which is actually
more conservative.
They call a Republican or Democrat who tends to be very friendly to Wall Street as a centrist.
Yeah.
I love what Paul Wellstone had to say about that years and years ago. That, yeah, I'm a centrist. I'm fighting for the issues that are central to the lives of my constituents.
Yeah.
He redefined it.
Absolutely.
And that's never caught, of course, that's never caught on with the mainstream media.
No.
And so, you know, they posture that there are these moderates, these centrists running against the far left.
Yeah.
The Democratic Socialists are far left. Even though, as you pointed out, and I think as others have pointed out too, a lot of what we have in this country is already basically socialism. Mm-hmm. I know you and I disagree about this, but I believe in the free market, not unbridled crony capitalism, which is what we unfortunately have.
Yeah.
I'd like to see I'd like to see the reestablishment of a true free market where there are there's a regulatory framework that allows people to invest their time, their energy, their passion, and some capital in an initiative that makes them a good living while they provide an important service or product.
Well, what I always say about is that, you know, if economics is the production, distribution, and consumption of goods and services, in politics is who gets what, then government is the L word, it's law. And so all selling and buying exist under the L word, which is law. So really there's no such thing as a free market. All markets are politically manufactured because all of them reside under the law. So my main argument is just that there's really no such thing as a 100% free market, but I understand what you're saying. A 100%. Freer market, freer market is what you would prefer, but I can't go outside of your door and sell opioids, you know, 40 cents a pill.
No, get on the block because to do that.
Because if there was a free market, I could do that. Or I could grow marijuana in my backyard and get a table and put it in Target and sell it.
I think you should.
But then I'd be arrested because
broccoli
nobody's
instead.
For the free market.
Yeah.
So, you know, so, I mean, you understand my
point. Yeah, I do.
But a freer market, I don't have a problem with. The farmer's market model, you grow your food here and you haul it down, but don't try to sell Oxycontin at your farmer's market. Then you'll get arrested and you'll say you're not in favor of free market, officer, and he won't be in favor of free market.
No, I mean, it's I like to compare it. I like to compare what I consider an ideal free market economy to America's favorite sport. It used to be baseball, now it's football. Football only works because there's a regulatory framework. You can't grab somebody by the face mask and throw them to the ground. You know, you can't punch them in the gut, you know. Mm-hmm. You can do a lot of things that are pretty violent in football, but there are rules and regulations, you know.
Absolutely.
If you go 10 yards, you get to try again. If you go 9 yards, you don't.
Yeah.
You know, the game does not work without a framework.
Sure.
And say the same with the economy, ideally a free market economy, does not work without a framework. Unfortunately, we've lost the framework. Or the framework
Absolutely.
Right now is so skewed in favor of a handful of very, very big, powerful capitalist
entities. Yeah, who gets to write the law of regulations? Is it capital or is it labor? And labor doesn't even really exist. I mean, it sort of exists almost in our imagination now, but the old time where capital sits around a big table and then labor sits on the other side. I mean, it barely even exists in our economy. I mean, I recommend techno-feudalism.
I think that sells labor a little bit. I think there have been some revivals in the labor movement that have been positive, but still, you're right. I mean, the capitalists,
the nature of work.
Those who have a heck of a ton of money get to call the shots, and largely because they get to buy the politicians who write the laws that favor them, that don't maintain that fair regulatory, you know, structure.
For sure.
That makes for a balanced economy. But I think
absolutely,
you and I would both agree.
Yeah,
and I think most people would agree that there has to be an element of socialism even in a free market economy.
Absolutely, and even in both Adam Smith and Marx wrote about that their fear of the capitalist class, the masters of the universe, so to speak, being able to buy the political class. And both of them were concerned. In fact, if I give a presentation on capitalism and socialism, I can give a whole bunch of quotes and ask who it is, and everybody says it's Marx and it's Adam Smith, the patron saint of capitalism. So that is true. I mean, the problem with socialism that even when you have, you know, I'm a Marxist professor and I shouldn't be mocking because it's, you know, Marxism, all life has a material basis, very interesting. But how do you replace the price signal? You know, the seller wants to sell as little as possible for as much as possible. Buyer wants to buy as much as possible for as little as possible. How do you actually replace that? What is your mechanism? And countries that are more trying to go all in on socialism, even North Korea is allowing a lot more markets and becoming, you know, a little bit freer society.
So to be clear, I mean, democratic socialism, as I understand it, and I'm not, I don't kind of use that term to describe myself, but as I understand it, they agree that to a certain extent, the economy should operate in kind of a capitalistic. I don't use the word capitalism because I don't like the way the money controls everything.
Sure,
but there's an element of freedom in how all that works. But when it comes to the roads, defense, well, we can talk about that.
Education.
Healthcare, education, making pollution control, you know, those things, that's a role for government.
Absolutely.
That's a role for society. Call it socialism, call it democratic socialism. But I think you'd be hard-pressed to find anybody out there who believes that roads should be entirely privatized.
Right.
That and I think we see increasing evidence that privatizing prisons is not a great idea.
Yeah.
Privatizing Medicare, Medicaid, not a great idea.
No. Yeah, you don't want to privatize your fire department, because if you get a fire and they show up, then, you know, the bidding begins. But you know, also you know, like I said, I like to explain it as the price signal for wants, but for needs, you need more government. And the polling really shows the Democratic Party voters are for a public option or Medicare for all. They would be for Switzerland's system or Germany's, you know, turning the for-profit insurance companies into nonprofits if they knew about it. That would actually be the best move for the United States and actually the most plausible. But once again, that would require Democratic voters being educated. I stopped on that. the other thing that you have, and so a social market economy or democratic socialism describes nearly every center right or center left party in South America, in Europe. The United States is an unusual country in that we have a lot of what are called negative liberties in our Bill of Rights, but the right to health care, or at least the right to not go broke paying for health care, social and economic rights, for most of the history of the United States, have not been understood by the U.S. public. Now they are. Hence another reason for my divorce, is that a number of people in the United States that belong to the Democratic Party, in particular, they're taking over the party, want a social market economy.
Yeah. Jeffrey, going to give you the last word, although it pains me to do so. folks, Jeffrey Weiss, poli-sci prof at Des Moines Area Community College, my guest today. Back in a minute, underwriting provided by Dr. Kim Holding with Story County Veterinary Clinic, serving Story County pets for over 30 years. More information at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design build services for high performance, low maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Underwriting for this program provided by Gateway Market, a Des Moines grocery and cafe offering artisan, local, and global foods, and catering for business and social events. More information at gatewaymarket.com. Hey, Kathy, welcome to the program. It's time for our monthly garden Q&A. We're a week behind schedule because you were on a research trip last week.
I was, and howdy, everyone in New York City. I miss you all.
This time of the year, of course, you're going to get a lot of questions about tomatoes.
Mm-hmm. And so many people are posting photos of their tomatoes, and there was a little discussion about, now, when do I pick these? So there were things about tomato picking I didn't know, so I went and learned from Penn State Extension, and I'm sure other extensions around the country have similar, but I did not know that there were six stages of tomato ripeness.
Six.
And at stage number two, you're okay to go ahead and pick that tomato.
So the toddler stage of tomato ripeness.
Right. Stage one is it's just absolutely green. Stage two is it's starting to lose that green color toward the stem end and is starting to get a little shade of yellow or maybe a little pink. At that point, and that's called the breaker stage, that means it's broken away from the needs of the nutrients from the tomato. It has everything it needs to develop its full flavor and ripeness and color. So the tomato quits sort of feeding it at that stage.
So you can pick a tomato when it's still green, in other words, and you'll get just as good of a tomato as if you let it sit on the vine until it's completely red.
And that's why when you see at the store that something is vine ripened, it doesn't mean they've left it on till stage six when it is fully red or the color that that tomato is going to turn at complete maturation. That growers will often, of course, pick at stage two because they're getting a good tomato. It's called vine ripened because it's got everything it needs from the vine.
I know we'll pick green tomatoes late in the season, October, for example, and then wrap them in newspaper, put them in a box, and they will eventually all ripen.
They will.
But what, I mean, you hear about big commercial operators who use, I think it's ethylene gas to induce the green tomatoes to turn red. What's that all about?
That's when they're picking them at stage one.
Okay.
When the tomato does not have everything the vine can give it to provide the full flavor and texture that you expect from a tomato, but they are flooding it with the ethylene gas because that's what turns it red faster, and they are selling you a tomato that does not have it has not achieved its full potential.
So it's missing a lot of nutritional value and also probably flavor.
I can't comment on the nutritional value. I'm talking about the plant giving the nutrients that the tomato needs to gain its maturity. I don't know how it affects the full nutrient of the tomato itself. But that's interesting. So you can pick early as soon as it gets its pink or other cast of color on it. And you might also avoid it being ripened more slowly in intense heat, such as above 85 degrees. Mm. So if you pick it early, you might actually have it ripen faster.
Interesting.
You also avoid further bug damage that you may be incurring, sun scald, and the splitting that tomatoes can have when they get deluged by too much water from heavy rain.
Blossom and rot. Can you actually avoid blossom and rot by picking them early enough?
That's hard because blossom and rot can set in stage one.
Okay, so
you can still eat those tomatoes.
So,
though.
I mean, just to stick on, I know we have more questions here, but just to stick on tomatoes a bit, blight is a huge problem.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no such thing as tomato blight, but there's all kinds of blights that affect tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And we're having some success with using copper sulfate as a spray, but I think
proactively.
Right, yeah, before we see it. But I think, proactively, the best things that you can do to prevent tomato blights or blights on your tomatoes, not planting in the same spot, only once, wait every 3 years before you go back and plant in the spot.
Or the same spot a potato had recently been in, or even a pepper, right?
Right, yeah. And, of course, mulching around the base of the plants to prevent soil from splashing onto them.
Mm.
Those kind of things make a huge difference. But so let me see. Oh, there's another question here, Kathy. This one. We're going to love this one. Does the black plastic or fabric that covers the soil in some gardens kill the microorganisms?
The answer actually is yes, and there are many reasons not to use the landscape fabric. One is that it can keep the water and nutrients from transferring throughout the soil. Of course, that makes your soil pretty dead underneath that plastic. It is designed to be somewhat porous, but it will eventually clog up after a while.
Mm.
And many of them eventually degrade, which means you have little pieces of basically a synthetic product in your garden.
And eventually in your food.
And they're in there. They're in there forever unless you have to dig it up. There are many garden places that say if you want to put something down to keep the weeds, just use more mulch. So people are putting mulch in, they want to go on the cheap, and they're putting the plastic under it, and it's not working.
I have so many more questions I'd love to get into, but we're running out of time here. Kathy, thanks so much for joining us.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, thanks to my guest today, Jeffrey Weiss, and to our production squad of Sherry Herdina, Forrest Ditterman, Charles Goldman, Kathy, and myself. Thanks also to the Des Moines Arbor Session for our bumper music. Underwriting provided by Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Westrum Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, architecture by Synthesis, and real estate agent Joe Henry. Also, Circle of Peacemakers, Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Bold Iowa, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, and Climate March. This is Ed Fallon, your host. We'll be back next week with another hour of Cutting Edge Talk Radio.
Well, you can go out and eat, and that's for sure, but there's nothing that a homegrown tomato won't cure. Put them in a salad, put them in a stew. You can make your own very own tomato juice. You can eat them with eggs and eat them with gravy. You can eat them with beans, pinto or navy. Put them on the side, put them in the middle. A homegrown tomato on a hot cake griddle. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What a life be without homegrown tomatoes. Only two things that one that came by, and that's